or burrows out like that of Lawrence Tynan and Marquez, either direction is powerful. In Proust, Hardy and Wolfe, the sexual power comes from studied inhibition. Proust's chiaroscuro shifting between direct and indirect revelations of homosexuality and sadomasochism. Hardy's savoured ironies about tragic sexual intolerance. Wolfe's characters constrained by their sexual caution and apprehensions. What her most poignant character, Louis in the Waves, described as his distractions to defend his infinitely young and unprotected soul. In Lawrence, Tynan and Marquez, the sexual power burrows outwards to the light, but this is an arduous and oppositional process. In Lawrence, the sexuality is finally insurrectionary in itself, and by its existence in exile, injurious to capitalist inhumanity. In Tynan, there is a deliberate quixotic emphasis on explicating the once uncomfortable. In Marquez, there is an identification of the doubts and complexities that might interfere with the purity of physical passion. As in the general in his labyrinth, he presents Simon Bolivar as complexly weighed down, and his lover Manuela Sands as idealistic and liberated, but perhaps lost to him. Marquez's depiction of Sands is very positive and contributed to dispelling puritanical prejudice against her in South America. But when I was acting as a sounding board for my daughter's recent translation of Sands and Bolivar's letters to each other, it was clear that Sands was much deeper and shrewder and their relationship much less doomed than that portrayed by Marquez. Marquez, of course, was temporarily dispirited regarding revolutions by the disastrous dissolution of the Soviet Union. But female sexuality never ceases to be a redeeming force in his work, whether it is that of the young girl in Of Love and Other Demons, whose long red hair grows back after she dies from an exorcism, or the 14-year-old prostitute in Memories of My Melancholy Whore, who becomes the love object of a 90-year-old male journalist. The hero's sexual fascination with her grows into his first profound erotic passion and is consummated not in sexual acts but by his devoting himself to providing for her education and welfare. It is interesting that this never seems to be a transcendence of sexuality but rather an insight into its expansive emotional potential. There is an obvious parallel between the above erotic outcome and that of Nabokov's Lolita, where the hero's obsession with nymphettes turns into helpless, ineradicable love for the grown-up Lolita, even though she is ruined, quotes, in terms of his sexual orientation. Nabokov was an influential asset of Western intelligence services during the Cold War, and any paradox in Lolita's thesis should be seen as a reaction to this. The furtive and fixated North American social landscape across which the characters travel is finally contradicted by the spontaneous overthrow of its acquisitory cunning. The intelligence service's own obsession with underage sexual objects might be seen as more than just a convenient means to blackmail, but as sometimes part of a larger philosophy. The cheerful knowingness reported and photographed in Ghislaine Maxwell's conversation, and Domena, for example, suggests that, like her publisher father, she felt genuinely idealistic in her patriotism and that her backers provided and instilled in her a worldly reassurance about recruiting unwitting young assets because they were also serving what was deemed to be the higher patriotic cause. To refer again to Maxwell in the Death Wish Moths context, it may be significant that the juror who has just suddenly declared that he had been sexually molested as a child, thus potentially giving grounds for a mistrial, has been revealed to be an employee of the Carlyle Financial Group. This group has been managed by US government figures such as the Bush family and CIA executives involved with buying and selling several arms companies and associated with Saudi Arabia. It is possible Maxwell was reassured that some such safety net would follow her conviction, but whether or not she should trust it is still worth some speculation. What contact has she had with Robert Maxwell since he disappeared from his yacht, pursued by disappointed creditors? On the subject of the Carlyle Group, we should remember that in 2004, the Centre for Public Integrity questioned the deliberate close interrelating between the group and political figures as access capitalism, a term invented to describe the group by Michael Lewis in 1993 in The New Republic. A former Carlyle CEO, Glenn Youngkin, was elected governor of Virginia as a supporter of Donald Trump, whose loss of the 2020 election he regards as illegitimate. Carlyle is also an owner of Nielsen Holdings, an American information, data and market measurement firm operating in more than 100 countries with at least 44,000 employees. Known office himself at Access Capitalism, Rupert Murdoch's HarperCollins recently suffered a defeat in the British High Court for libel against a Russian, Roman Abramovich, and the Russian State Oil Company. The book was part of a larger project to fuel anti-Russian feeling and conflict in keeping with General Fox and News Corp sentiment. Another current peculiarity in propaganda book publishing that I would like to discuss further here later is the spate of supposedly sympathetic biographies, some by Australians, of left-wing heroes which actually undermine their political positions and stress their pathology and psychological and social flaws. Recent books on Paul Robeson, Henry Lawson and Ethel Rosenberg are particularly irritating in this regard and often read like falsely empathetic CIA files. One rival to HarperCollins is Penguin Random House, owned by German conglomerate Bertelsmann, controlled by the Mern family, with a pro-capitalist philosophy and once the largest book producer for the Wehrmacht. Murdoch recently had a partial victory, however, when Penguin Random House's bid to take over Simon & Schuster was put on hold by the Department of Justice on the grounds that Penguin would have owned nearly half the book market in America. On the subject of anti-Russian propaganda, I have been meaning to differentiate more distinctly between Red Sparrow and Honey Traps. Red Sparrows, as I've suggested, are largely a CIA fantasy, but honey traps, such as those innocents procured by Ghislaine Maxwell, do seem to be a significant political factor. Of the two women who accused Assange, one had a CIA history but probably no training in seduction. She simply turned up back at her flat as his host and he was, as expected, obliging. But the other, who was influenced by her and was thought at the time by Assange's other Swedish hosts to be some strange type of interloping seductress, seems to have been genuinely surprised by the seriousness of the legal outcome. On that topic, it has always seemed to me that the fact that the condom one of the women took to the police station as evidence against Assange showed no traces at all of semen when analysed was in fact a great piece of historical comedy, since the rape accusation involved him purportedly not using a condom. Any sperm on the condom would have actually defeated their case, so they must take in an unused one. We should acknowledge how logical that indeed was. It has a quietly droll logic that would have appealed to Virginia Woolf. And having begun to discuss Woolf's sexuality and some of the enormous publishing empires, it is time to look at the history of a smaller publisher, Hogarth Press, to examine Woolf's role in it and, without pathologizing her, to ask why she relinquished it and what sexual complexities were involved. There is a tendency among some feminists to blame Leonard Woolf for Virginia's difficulties. One novelist even suggested he murdered her. But Virginia was a powerful strategist and extremely sexually discerning, and her decisions must be afforded critical respect. Her fabled love affair with Vita Sackville West, beginning in 1925 and the subject of a romantic film now being revived on SBS, was a judicious choice by her.